Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Nunes is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. Happy we don't play Clemson week.
Yeah, we don't have to face them for at least another, well, it's probably going to be about 50 weeks.
50 weeks.
Since yeah, we're definitely facing them next year to start the year.
Honestly, just that's fine. Get it out of the way.
Yeah, just start 0-1, and then from there, just win the next 11. That's fine. Honestly, I think we'll talk a little bit about this game, hopefully in ways that we haven't to this point or anyone else has to this point. Dan, I'm starting to think that we're the ones who Clemson has our number in this series. I know that sounds like a contrarian take, but if you look at the other than the blowout win for Clemson in 2016, SU's been pretty snake bitten in these games and has had a chance to win a hell of a lot of them.
Yeah, I mean, we almost won the game down there in, I think, what, Schaefer's second year?
Yeah, 2014.
A horrific slugfest. That
not even only, football?
It was real bad on both ends. Like, Clemson didn't play well at all. Credit to, like, that was probably one of the best, honestly, probably one of the best coaching jobs of Schaefer's head coaching tenure was keeping them in that game. And then you go with, obviously, 2 years ago we won, and then last year we probably should have won. It's tough because you don't want to like sell yourself short on really good efforts against what is right at this moment the best program in college football, but it would be nice to have a second win and really like make your mark there. At the same time, you know, it's not like anyone else has had much more success there.
Also, like, don't forget the 2015 Mahoney game.
Oh yeah, that wasn't a terrible.
That was a 10-point loss too, and that was a game that was very much still in the balance. Like at the end, like within the last like 7-8 minutes. Like, not to say that like we're almost as good as Clemson because we're not, and I don't want this like be misconstrued if there's any Tigers fans chiming in here, but more to just say like I feel like SU is the team that Clemson has their number, and like that Clemson's managed to close the door on us numerous times when we've had the upset ready to go, and like. You know, I kind of mentioned this in the Nunes letter this morning. Like, there's an alternate reality where we've won all these games.
Yeah, and I think that's like one of the marks of like being a great team is like you win those games and you don't get rattled in the fourth quarter and you make the plays in the last like 8 minutes that you're required to make. And you know, our team's done that once, and you know, we know what a win over Clemson looks like. You make a lot of, you know, really big clutch plays, and there were so many moments this past weekend where you're like, oh yeah, in 2017 Taj Harris makes that catch for the first down. We don't have like the really bad drops, we have blitz pickups,
fewer penalties,
the penalties, like you see, you we've all seen what the blueprint for a win over Clemson is. And this weekend we did a number of things that you know, picking off Trevor Lawrence twice, like you need those kind of plays, those big impact defensive plays. Unfortunately, we just completely failed to translate them into points and do whatever it was necessary to keep Clemson on their toes. So ultimately, they were able to kind of coast at the end. which is, I think, kind of like the frustrating thing about that game. It was 40-6. Obviously, the last touchdown was total garbage time for them on both sides. We were both playing second stringers.
Really bad beat.
Yeah. There was the Amari Rodgers touchdown, which I know it wasn't like the most decisive thing in the world. I don't know how you look at the replay 85 times like we all did and not say, like, he almost definitely touched out of bounds.
Yeah, I think that's the problem. Is the ruling, if the ruling on the field had been he was out of bounds, I feel like they would have been hard pressed to overturn. But because they ruled that he was stayed in bounds,
it was like there's a universe in which his heel never actually touched down. I just struggle to find that that's actually what happened. At the same time, Cordy needs to just make a tackle and not try to shove him out, because it's Amari Rodgers. He's a 5-star, like, super strong, brutally fast receiver who somehow recovers from ACL surgery in like 5 months. You need to make a tackle there. You can't just, like, you can't put that into any question.
Yeah, that has nothing to do with the size either. Like, I mean, admittedly, and I talked about this with, like, Seth Goldberg on Twitter, and I mentioned it in numerous posts, like, I understood what they were doing trying to cycle out corners, and, like, specifically, like, Ifeatu Melifonwu, Trill Williams, and Cordy got a lot of looks at corner in a 4-3 alignment, but problem is, like, none of those guys are necessarily, like, Melifonwu is a starting corner. Cordy is a former safety who plays nickel and is 5'8". Like, that Cordy, like, they seem ready to die on that, like, to paraphrase, like, Richard Johnson, like, over at Banner Society. Like, they very much seem ready to die on that hill of, like, having their receivers beat Cordy and, like, daring them to do so. And, like, Cordy's a very good player, but I don't think Cordy's good enough to overcome, you know, that height disadvantage that Clemson was happy to take advantage of this entire game.
Yeah, and the other problem is that you're playing Clemson, who has three receivers that would probably be the number one receiver on, and I'm not going to be, like, outrageous in saying this, 128 college football teams. I'd say maybe Alabama, I'd say, has the best receiver in the country, in Jerry Jeudy. And then Clemson's trio of T. Higgins, Amari Rodgers, now evidently healthy, and Justin Ross, who barely made, you know, I don't know, have his numbers in front of me, didn't even make, like, a much of a splash. Justin Ross caught 5 for 64, so not a bad game. But, like, you can make an argument that Justin Ross is the best receiver on that team, and he was, like, the third most impactful one. T. Higgins is a matchup nightmare. Like, no one has 6'4 corners to throw out that guy. And honestly, like, none of his plays even bothered me, because they were just, like, jump balls that, you know, he is one of a handful of receivers that are going to make, and, like, largely our defenders were in decent position. Like, those kind of plays, like, don't honestly bother me that much, because your guys are playing the best they can, and when a 6'4" future number first-round pick makes a catch like some of the ones he made, it is what it is. It's, like, the effort plays and not tackling Rodgers over the sideline and some of those things that bother me. But at the same time, like, I don't want to – you know, we've kind of let off of the defense here. The defense is the only reason we were in this game at all. They made some huge, huge plays that – you know, in the 2017 game, those two interceptions lead to two touchdowns. That's what you need to do to beat Clemson. This year, they led to 0 points, which is outrageous. And, you know, is really the defining thing in this game. Like, there were moments here where we were like, we could have at least made it a legitimate, like, challenge at the end. And we just kept on falling short on those issues. And I think, you know, largely because DeVito wasn't sharp, but I think more because Brent Venables decided he was going to blitz Tommy DeVito what felt like about 75% of the time. And
they didn't do anything about it.
It worked so often. Like, I can't remember one time where we're like, oh, we really blocked that up, and now they have to think. The only times were the Moneal dump-offs.
And those weren't even blocked. Those were just, they were designed to deal with the blitz. And I don't understand what the hell, like, I think we're going to get to, like, all the people that are done with Dino after this game, and there were plenty of really bad Syracuse fans, and those people are always bad. This is not, like, a unique thing for them being bad, but there were so many bad Syracuse fans and bad Syracuse fans takes after this game that it became a little exhausting. But, like, there is a legitimate gripe with some of the play calling, how SU dealt with the blitz, the fact that the one time they decided to opt for quick passes, like, Mo Neal was right there for big gains, and then SU kind of got away from that approach for the rest of the time. I mean, people will center in on DeVito's pick, and that was abhorrent. And really, like, I had me beside myself in a lot of ways.
There's no excuse for it. Like, he threw to no one. He was
for the third straight game.
Yes,
the same goddamn pass.
My biggest fear is that now it's so obvious that if you just get an edge rusher to flush DeVito to the right, he will throw a ball to the sideline where there could be a receiver there. There could not be. He was going to throw the ball inbounds, and it gives you an ample opportunity to pick it off. It's happened 3 games in a row. Like, and he did that so many times, and it's actually shocking he has some more interceptions like that, because like you can tell, especially in college, when like quarterbacks who get rattled have like kind of like a tick or kind of like a safety valve, and you hope it's something a little more healthy than just like go to the sideline and chuck one up. And that's clearly it for DeVito, and they need to break that. They need to break that habit of his, because it is horrifying. And also, like, throwing a pick to the sideline is like one of the worst things you can do, because you have half, you know, in all likelihood, half of your offense, if you're rolled out that far, is not there to make a tackle afterwards if you throw an interception. So there, I mean, he's gonna throw pick sixes like that regularly. So hopefully they just drill that out of him this week, because it is really awful, and you're just never putting yourself in a good situation. Obviously, like, going into the year, we were hoping, we didn't think our offensive line was going to struggle this much, but we were hoping that you'd see more from we'd see more of like a pocket, you know, around DeVito, and he, you know, is clearly more comfortable when he has good protection. Who isn't? But like Eric Dungy last year, and I hate to, like, every week you have to make the DeVito Dungy comparisons, but they're kind of natural at this point. Dungy, for, you know, had some issues in that, like, he was prone to taking these big sacks. He would occasionally try to make something happen, but the plays he would make, he would negotiate a pocket that was chaotic way better in and outside of the pocket. He was unafraid to kind of, you know, pick up the yardage given to him. But also, like, he didn't make those kind of mistakes. Like, his mistakes were like 8 yard losses versus, you know, interceptions that there was like a one, maybe a 0.5% chance that somehow a Syracuse player was going to catch that ball.
I mean, I can think of two different circumstances where that did happen, but yes, I'd say by and large, Tommy already has more of those throws than Dungy did. Like, and Tommy's a much better passer, which is the confusing part. Like, I think what everyone undersold about Dungy, I think us included, and most Syracuse fans, is that he really did cover up for what was an average to below average offensive line last year, because he was so good at throwing on the run, because he was so good at as you said, you know, doing a lot with a chaotic pocket. Like, he managed to just extend plays. Like, all of those things add up to all of those big plays that he made and those gains out of nowhere. And just the offense itself, and I think, you know, maybe even Dino Babers and the offensive staff maybe forgot about this a little bit too. Like, you know, DeVito can't throw on the run right now, which is, like, right now his progressions are drop back, start reading. If you start feeling a blitz, immediately roll out, mostly to the right. Immediately roll out. While you're rolling out, do not look for any targets. Just try to elude pressure and then try to reestablish yourself close to the sideline. Like, that's not going to work at the Power 5 level. It's barely going to work at the G5 level, depending on your opponent. Like, I think DeVito's a great player, and I think he's very talented. I do, however, think that we're falling victim to some of the things that just this offensive line is stopping him from being able to do, and he can't close this gap automatically and just become someone who's comfortable throwing on the run, who's comfortable in a chaotic pocket, who's comfortable, you know, making quick plays and finding safety valves quickly and going through his progressions quickly. Like, because the offensive line isn't ready and has been banged up, DeVito just can't look the part, and that's the crux of why we are struggling so much right now.
Yeah, I'd say if there's a bright, you know, not a bright spot, but like a silver lining, is that offensive line is one of those places where you can see development during the year. Like, we saw it last year, our offensive line got a lot better throughout the season. We've seen it in years past. We're like, 2012 comes to mind. Early on, like, we really struggled in some tough fronts, and then by year's end, it was like a strength of ours, and we were running the ball really well. So I think, like, if you're to develop at a spot, like, once we find that chemistry, and hopefully some of these young guys who are inexperienced come along, we'll figure it out a bit better. But so far, it's been really rough. Now, you know, I think Maryland's front looked pretty decent. Of course, Temple kind of manhandled them this weekend, which didn't feel great. Clemson didn't have like the four studs up front like they had last year, but they made up for it by running just a hectic number of different stunts and different looks. And Venables, like, really got in his bag for that game, and it worked, you know, spectacularly. He did everything possible to confuse our O-line. So we probably won't have to face any teams that are of the Clemson caliber, and maybe some that are just kind of below average. The ACC looks really bad this year. So hopefully we'll be able to kind of get it together by midseason here and then really make a run at it. But right now, like, the offensive line is not gelling with what DeVito is good at. And I think that's where most of the problems stem from. And that's unfortunate because there's, like, you know, we need to figure it out. It's not like it's an excuse, but there's, you can't just say it and then that's like, that's it. You know, just as you identified it, like, we need to make it work somehow. And I also think, like, going back to the original point here in general, I don't know how you're going to say you're going to be done. Like, there was people in Twitter this weekend. And I know this isn't like a super great representation of everybody, but, like, I don't think you can say you're done with Babers after two bad games or even three, if you want to roll in Liberty and then discount like all of last year. Like, these things all roll in, and like, you can't just throw out all of the like nice things that we saw the first 2 years where he was clearly rebuilding the program, and then a 10 win season where, yeah, he like the roster came together, but that's what happens for new coaches. Like, they hit a point where like the veterans come together and you add in the new pieces and things gel. You can't just like dispatch those because this season is happening in front of you and like, oh, two bad games, you gotta throw them away. I think Babers like, takes a lot of the blame for these first three games on offense. It's his offense. But at the same time, I think we should all know better and say there's, you know, plenty of evidence that he should be able to get this back on track and figure some things out by mid-season.
Yeah, I completely agree. I have full faith that Babers is going to be able to get this back on track, and maybe back on track is 7-5. You know, because at the end of the day, like, I forgot where this was said, that, like, you know, Babers' offense is only as good as the slowest lineman. Right now, linemen aren't necessarily great, so everything else has kind of fallen apart. Like, realistically, where we've given, you know, Clemson fits in recent years is because, you know, Venable's defense is largely based on, you know, those pre-snap adjustments and a lot of switching and those changes. And, like, if you run tempo, and, you know, I understand that there's more to it than just that, but if you're a good team running at tempo, it becomes very hard for Clemson to do those things that they like to do pre-snap to create chaos on the other end. Like, you saw when SU was snapping quickly, they were making things happen. And I think in general, you know, that also extends to kind of my larger critique about, and like, I don't really have the time to dig into the full red zone breakdown for Babers' entire tenure, but this year in particular, you can see it, like, the few times SU's been in the red zone, Babers has a tendency to kind of pack it in a little bit when SU gets close to the end zone. And I think that's why we've struggled in the red zone so much in recent years, is just because, like, we run a completely different offense. Now, the past few years, having Dungy there, you know, having that bootleg look, having the ability for him to dive, like, all that's great and is covered up some issues. And we've still had it, again, a below average red zone offense in that case. But, like, now when we don't have that look, I mean, you saw the bootleg was sniffed out immediately when SU tried it against Clemson. Like, we have to, I think, adjust at this point and realize that, like, going big and trying to power it in after you've spread everybody out for the entirety of that drive is a poor idea. It's not working. And with this personnel, like, what we've done in the past is also not going to work. So I this isn't to hammer Babers. I think if there's one place that I would circle as maybe an area for just SU's coaching staff to improve, it's this specific area where I get, like, especially, to be honest, it should be second nature, because if your offensive line is struggling, then you want to get the ball out quickly. Then you want to be able to snap the ball quickly and move. So I feel like, yeah, trying to power past an opponent, especially a more talented and superior opponent the way Clemson was, trying to power past them inside the five, with this offensive line in particular, just seems like a fool's errand.
Yeah, like I think in general, like, we've seen that spreading defenses out works, and I think that still holds near the goal line. Like, I get the inclination to want to go big and just stuff it in, and like, I think there are situations where you try that. I think in football in general, we're past the point where you run a dive or a fullback dive or a quarterback sneak three plays in a row. I think there are advantages to having four wide and run some stunts, run some kind of light, unenforceable rub routes, and just do those kind of things that put you still keep your numbers advantage and keep your space advantage, especially with like a one step drop and throw or so. And I know there are like risks there as well, but I think you can keep like some of the more, you know, old school power football elements in there, but you can't just rely on those for like three straight downs and then, you know, end up pulling a Pat Narduzzi and taking a field goal off the upright. Like, you need to actually give some different looks in the red zone. And that has been a struggle for Babers, probably more than anything else, through the full tenure here. And also, just because we were on the topic, I went and looked it up because some people think that we automatically win 11 games this year because we won 10 last year. The last time, if we were to go 7, if we were to go 7-6 this year, like lose a bowl game or just expect to win a bowl game, the last time we had 17 wins in a 2-year stretch was 1998 to 1999. Actually, 97 to 98. So this isn't like every. This isn't like where we've always been. It's been a long time since we won 17 games over the course of two seasons. So we can calm down if that's what happens. Like, that is still incremental progress. Maybe it's a slight step back from where we thought we were going to be. But, like, if we, you know, right the ship here and get to 7 wins in any way, or 8 wins even, like, that's still so much better than Syracuse has been over a 2-game stretch in decades. Since, like, way before Coach P thought he was going to get fired. Like, this was still pretty prime Coach P. So that's wild, and we need to like accept that as where our program's been.
Well, I mean, seeing all the comments, seeing all the Twitter stupidity, seeing all the Facebook stupidity, like I said, I know there's plenty of good fans out there, and I've interacted with plenty of them. You have too. At the same time, like, how many times were people like beating the, we're going 10-2 and there's no other way I see the season ending drum? Like, even reasonable folks leading up to, I mean, you and I even like saw 9-3.
We predicted nine.
Yeah, we predicted nine. We did say there was an easy road to get to 7, though. And here we are. Like, saying you and I and other people that said 9 also said that, I mean, there were plenty of people outside the Syracuse fan base that said 9-10 wins. But like, we said 9. We said, but 7 was a distinct possibility. Like, there's a lot of people banging the drum for 9-10 wins as the floor. Like, here, like, did everyone just like forget what this program is, what this team is, like the talent level on the team? It's not to say the talent level is bad. It's not, but talent level's no better than top 50. And like, sometimes that team will get good breaks. Sometimes they'll get bad breaks. I think, you know, I wrote on Sunday, like this whole season still ahead of us. There's in most iterations of this season, we were losing to Clemson, so check. In most iterations of the season, we were beating Liberty, check. So really, you know, getting blown out by Maryland, maybe that's, you know, the outlier right now. We don't know, but there's still 9 games left. And if Syracuse goes 5-4 in them, we're going to a bowl game. I just think people need to recalibrate. Just, I said this before the season, and I got shouted down by some folks who were claiming that I was trying to hedge. Like, and I know like other more realistic people have been shouted down too. Like, this is how it goes. Being back isn't as simple as just winning 10 games and being ranked. Like, you know, that's part of it. That's part of getting back, is getting to that point and being able to plant that flag and being able to say you won 10 games recently and being able to be a part of the national conversation. But you have to do that consistently and, you know, cashing in on those seasons and getting the better talent level and keeping the good coaches is how you get there consistently and how you are actually back. I mean, ask USC how often they're quote unquote back versus actually back. Ask Miami. It has numerous other programs too, like Virginia Tech lately, to be honest. Like Oregon even, where like Oregon's kind of like, you know, taking on some water. They're still doing really well, but like they've taken on some water against more elite opponents. Like, I'm very confused as to like, and I was confused all offseason as to like what everyone had to live themselves into. And I apologize if I was part of how that delusion got started and how it perpetuated, but like, let's be real about who we are, what we are and what Syracuse's program is. And just again, recalibrate and say, this is what's still on the table. This is what's still here for us. And 7-5, like we said, literally like 10 months ago, 7-5 this year has always been in play, and it would always be a success.
Yeah. I think some people just expected to like skip steps where like we got to 10 wins last year and they thought we were going to jump up into like, I don't know, the Wisconsin tier of like sub national championship contender, when really like there are a lot of teams that win 10 games occasionally. like, you want to get back to the point where, like, oh, Syracuse only made the Military Bowl. That's actually kind of disappointing. That's where we want to be. Right now, like, when we make a bowl, it's like, oh, nice season for them. And we want to get to the point where, like, making a bowl is the bare minimum. We want to get to, like the mid-level, like, TCU level of, like, this program can be special every so often. They have good coaching, and most, and they're going to be involved every year. Like,
and it took them forever to get there.
Yeah, and it took them so long, and it took a lot of
team surrounded by talent.
Yeah, it took a lot of programs. Like, it takes, you know, multiple good coaching hires. It takes really good infrastructure. It takes a will to get there. And then you can maybe consider, then you can do the Clemson thing, which, you know, one team every decade maybe does, and then vault yourself into the top tier. But Clemson was like mired in, like, if not mediocrity, they were in that, like, Wisconsin tier for the longest time, for like, oh yeah, I'm going to win nine games every so often.
And they fell short plenty of times. I mean, they dipped into a 5-6 win season, you know, once every 5 years. I mean, Clemsoning was a thing. Like, Clemson was always
the West Virginia team, like a national embarrassment.
Yeah, getting blown off the field in the Orange Bowl.
Which is honestly what led to, like, the staff.
Venables getting, Venables. Yeah, literally, like, in, this story's been written numerous times where they got blown off the field. Obviously, they were replacing the defensive staff. Venables was kind of falling out of favor with Stoops and that regime at Oklahoma. Declining.
The West Virginia team that we beat, by the way. Yeah. Same team.
Yeah, same team. But yeah, like, Venables was falling out a little bit, and his numbers for his guys had it kind of declined year over year for a few seasons, but not to any significant level. I mean, it was still like a top 50 defense. And Dabo came in, and credit to Dabo, who I'm not always a huge fan of, but I think what he does and how he empowers his assistants is so huge for that program. Like, as he brought him in and let him just go to work, and Venables has now made that defense one of the, like, one of the hallmarks of college football is Clemson having an aggressive, athletic defense that can pretty much do anything you task them with.
Yeah, I think if you take away, like, the, like, weird, very well-publicized religiosity of the Dabo Swinney program, which I'm going to for the sake of conversation here, which I don't think either of us is a huge fan of, and is also not, like, very replicable, I don't think. Dabo Swinney did a brilliant job of understanding exactly what he was good and not good at when he took over that job, which, if on paper, he had no right to get. Like, it was when he was hot, when he was promoted as the interim coach, you're like, whatever. He had some nice wins.
They made a good, like, recruiter, and then spat it.
Honestly, it looked like the Scott Schaefer hire. Like, they hired him the year after. You're like, okay, see what he can do. If not, you know, you don't invest in a big time coach. He knew that he was not done a, you know, he wasn't done a steam up stuff. Like, he was a wide receiver starts before that. He was a really good recruiter, and he was charismatic, and he apparently was just had these good management skills. And he did an incredible job of filling in these holes. He for a long time took a lot, not really anymore, because the school, Clemson's probably as dedicated to building this football program as any program in the country. Especially, like, considering where they were, they've just, like, really made sure this is what they're doing as a university vision. Like, going forward, this was, like, the biggest thing for the university, and it's probably worked. I guarantee you their enrollment and their numbers are all up as a result. He just made sure to go get, like, the best possible coaches he could, empower them, tell them to do their own stuff, pay them incredibly well. And that's, like, a legit, I think, reputable model, more so than, like, the class that, like, every SEC team goes and hires a Saban assistant, and, like, one of them has worked out so far, and that's Kirby Smart. Saban's a rare coaching talent. I don't know that Dabo's a rare coaching talent. I think Dabo gets it better than most coaches with his level of ability. I think he understands his own weaknesses and has just, like, really adapted to them. And to, like, incredible results. And that's why you see, like, Ed Orgeron's doing the same thing now. Like, Coach O was, like, a good position coach, an incredible recruiter, charismatic. He's not going to go draw up an offense for you or a defense for you. So he went and hired, like, Dave Aranda. He went and just poached the coach from the Saints, who's, like, completely reforming their offense. You know, he knew, like, hey, if I don't get this turned around in a year, I'm probably going to get fired in a year or two. So let me go just do something radically different and figure this out rather than be worried about, like, running this program the way I've always envisioned it. And, like, I think that's more replicable than what Saban does, where Saban's just an amazing coach. I think you can appreciate Swinney for that and, like, and what he's built there. Because that honestly is, like, they're the only team that's become a blue blood in how many years? Like, 20, 25.
They're really it since Florida. Like,
yeah, that's probably the answer.
Yeah, like I couldn't think of another one. Like, an Oregon, like, can get all Oregon, shitty about I this think, if they I want, but to win a title.
National title. And if Oregon had won a title, they would be there, I think. They just didn't.
It'd be so close. I mean, you and I have talked about this before. Like, Oregon is the only school to really buy their way into that conversation. Like, everybody else has. Clemson, but Clemson didn't buy it, I would say. I think Clemson built it.
They invested in it.
They invested in it and, like, didn't have a mega booster. They didn't have, like, the same machinations that Oregon did. I think Clemson really, like, built it over time and had the infrastructure in place. Oregon literally just dumped money into starting from scratch, basically, and said, all right, Oregon's a thing now, and then spent the money to match up with that. So yeah, I think Clemson's the only school, just like in basketball, I think Villanova's the only school to get themselves in. And I still don't think Villanova's in that, like, top tier conversation. I think Clemson has put themselves in it.
I think football's so much harder that, like, Clemson has. Nova, I think the biggest argument you make against Nova is
consistency. We want to see what happens.
Yeah.
Post Jay Wright.
Yeah, we want to see what happens after Jay Wright. And you could say the same thing about Clemson, but I think Clemson has built, like, I feel more comfortable with saying Clemson, if Dabo leaves for the Alabama job at some point, will be.
Because it's now a super desirable job. It's now a job that you want and need, and you understand the path to get into national championship. I think for Villanova, sure, there's a script there, but realistically, we've seen it happen before. If you lose, if those fans become disengaged, you're still in the Big East. You're still at a money disadvantage. You still have the script to winning at Villanova is the same script to winning at Virginia. It's the same script to winning at most of the Big East schools. It's the same script to winning at a bunch of the ACC schools too. There's not like this special formula there, where at Clemson, there are factors that make it a very different type of job.
Yep. So this is all to say that the Clemson model should show you that, like, this does not happen overnight, and it doesn't happen as you won 10 games at once. So we need to just, like, there's just no universe in which Babers, like, is not even being discussed for the hot seat this year, unless, like, the locker room explodes, which I don't think is going to happen. Like, maybe there are some issues because the team isn't doing well. But, like, let's see the season play out, and then we'll evaluate where everything is. But, like, he's not going anywhere. He hasn't forgotten how to coach overnight. And I agree, he hasn't coached well in these first three games. It's probably the worst three-game stretch of his time here. I think it's most likely a blip because
we still improved this past game.
Yeah, we did improve, and, like, the defense improved a lot. Like, I actually thought the defense, you know, was a big step forward from Maryland. They've gave up, like, 23 fewer points. But also, like, one of those touchdowns is a write-off. Another one, like, big players make good plays. It is what it is. Like, the defense there's a very realistic universe in which the defense, like, only gave up 28 points in that game, and against Clemson, you'll sign for that. I think they got that side of it. If they play the same defense they played against Clemson and it's everyone, because the talent level's not going to be there for any other team we play, we're probably going to win some games just on the strength of the defense. So unless they go get lit up by Western Michigan this weekend, I'm not going to be too concerned about that side of the ball. I think there's a very good chance the Maryland game was an aberration. Offensively, we got to figure it out, and that's Babers' side of things. But, like, we've seen consistent progression on offense every year. A three-game blip isn't going to make me write him off as a coach. That's just a ridiculous thing to do.
Agreed. Why don't we take a little bit of break for our sponsor?
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And Dan, let's talk some halftime. What have you been drinking?
I've had a nice little mix of newer stuff and older stuff. The new thing I had was a Headway IPA from Counterweight Brewing, which is up in Hamden, Connecticut. I had never had anything from them, I don't think. But this was a super, super tasty, citrusy IPA. Really enjoyed that. I had a Samoa this from Southern Tier, which is a, you know, as you can probably get from the name, kind of coconutty, chocolatey stout. I also had a couple things from Wolf Hollow, out of their Campout Stout. I had their Oktoberfest, which was really delicious. I had a Tank 7 from Boulevard, which is always a go-to when I see that pop up. I had Toted Tiles from LAC Beer Project, one of my favorite New York beers. And I think that's the list.
Fair enough. For me, nothing too crazy. I really just drank the same thing a couple days in a row. I had a 4-pack of Modern Times Ghost Mountain New England IPA. It was hazy, but not overly so. And then I had Russian Rivers STS Pils, which is a really good one. And since Russian Rivers upped their production of late, I've seen it quite a bit on shelves, so I'm always happy to grab it. It's cheap. It's very good. But highly recommend it for those who are out in this area, because it's really the only place you're going to get it. But why don't we talk one more thing about Clemson, and then I promise we'll head to WMU. There's a reality, Dan, where late in third quarter, Syracuse is up 20-17. I think that's the thing that kills me here, and that's what why I immediately, and I know I tagged you on Twitter on this, immediately think that this game needs to go in the dumb game pantheon, and it won't look like the rest of them, and I think that's why it occupies its own wing, because the things that happened in this game, the way it made me feel, was just a very unique dynamic, and one that, like, I can't recall another game that looked the way this one did and yet made me feel the way this one did at the same time.
Yeah. See, I had trouble when you sent the dumb game thing to me, because it does feel so different than the rest of them. I think a large part of it's that, like, we caught, again, Trevor Lawrence. I know last time we played him was his first start. Trevor Lawrence didn't look particularly good. Now, he hasn't really looked that great this year in general. I think he's suffering.
He's looked good enough.
He's looked good enough. He has a ton of talent around him, but, like, the best throw he made was probably the jump ball to Higgins. That was a gorgeous throw. But Higgins did, like, the hardest part of it. And that was kind of the thing with this. Like, his best throws, his receivers' unique talents were the reason that they were successful. And that's, you know, you understand your talent around you, but, like, that's still not exactly what, like, you know, your quarterback, because he, like, even if he gets, if he's a number one pick, like, he's not going to have that same advantage with some, you know, crappy NFL team. Obviously, that's a discussion for down the road since he has another year. But, like, the fact that you can't take advantage of, like, Lawrence giving a pretty mediocre performance, and, like, the two stops in the red zone on offense, like, it was its own brand, I think. And I think there is, like, a difference between a dumb game, like, two bad Syracuse and Louisville teams playing versus like Syracuse punching up and just, like, being held at arm's length, which there's gonna be a few of those.
Fair. Yeah, I think, you know, when we finally dive into what constitutes a dumb game and the levels of dumb game, we'll see if that is its own wing, if it doesn't even qualify. Yeah, I do feel like, you know, looking at a 41-6 final score and saying that game was closer than this looked feels like a really desperate attempt to, like, make it a thing. But when you look at, when you watch the game, when you saw how SU could have very, very easily been up 20-17 at that juncture, like, that's really the killer, is how not only did we lose, but the appearance of the game looks like it was a definitive loss where SU was just buried from the beginning and could never get it going. And it really, I mean, we said this throughout the game in Slack, like, at one point, the only reason we were losing was because of ourselves, and that sounded absolutely insane against the top team in the nation.
Yeah, it's because for every big play we made offensively, or every big play Clemson made offensively, like, we had a big play like that defensively. Arguably more, like, the stop in the first drive was awesome. Like, we looked like we were coming out swinging. The dome on TV sounded louder than I can ever remember, which I guess is what happens when you put in 50,000 people. And kudos to SU for finding the extra couple hundred seats in there. Because I think we were stuck at, like, that 49-250 number for a while in terms of capacity. So I guess we found some spots for people. And it was just tough to, like, and honestly, like, I thought the fans, obviously people filed out early. I get it. I thought the fans did a nice job. Like, that place was loud through, like, the entire time this game was competitive. I thought the fans did a really, really good job. And I think that's part of it. Like, we were just so close knocking on the door of like even staying in it late when we were down what was like 28-3 or 28-6, and like it looked like we were gonna finally score a touchdown. Like that, like the game wasn't really over until probably the early to mid fourth quarter. But like when you look at the numbers, sits 12-187 total yards, like you're like 41 sits actually doesn't even seem like what that should have been. But honestly, it was in the reverse where like Syracuse probably played like a 3-touchdown loss versus whatever this ended up being. But the actual raw numbers looked like Clemson should have hunted Sitzky on us.
Right. Yeah, and again, that's a testament to the defense and what they were able to do. I think, you know, I give them a lot of credit. I think they've been under fire a little bit this year. Despite the shutout in game one, they obviously looked miserable in game two. In this one, I'm very confused as to why Cordy was, you know, in those mismatches so much. I was surprised to see Trill out there, but Trill got an interception. Chris Frederick, honestly, not enough has been made about that interception. Because that was a tip drill to himself, where the athleticism and the presence of mind that it takes to do that should not be discounted. Like, Frederick is a baller, and you and I have been talking about him in particular. Like, he's not going to get all ACC nods the way he should at the end of this year, but realistically, like, he's somebody who is going to be on some draft radars. And I think anyone who's really paying attention and has seen how he's improved year over year since he's been at Syracuse, like, Frederick's somebody that I think is a pretty good shot at getting drafted. And if not for some reason, he's somebody who can play his way onto a roster.
Yeah, I think like defensively, we've had like this pretty like unfortunate, like we were doing really well in the NFL draft towards the end of Marone for a while, which, you know, credit to his recruiting. He clearly like evaluated really well because the recruiting classes weren't any better than they are on paper right now. I think the Schaefer era, we really like just bottomed out in terms of NFL draft picks.
And it happens when you have no talent on the roster.
Yeah, turns out. I think that's going to come reverse like really quick. I don't know if we're going to have like the back-to-back number, you know, first round picks like we had with Pugh and Chandler Jones. Chandler Jones, by the way, who I think is leading the NFL in sats over the last like 3 years or so.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe one of the most underrated players in the NFL, just quietly, you know, rolling up double-digit sats every year.
So because he plays in Arizona now, so nobody knows what the hell's going on.
Yeah, but even when he was a Patriot, like, yeah, I think the Patriot, like, thing is just that, like, aside from Brady and Gronk while he was there, like, no one got, like, the particular credit. And so it wasn't, like, just a Chandler thing. But, like, he's been, like, incredible his entire NFL career, and I hope he somehow starts to get more respect for it. But obviously we had those two. And Pugh, I think, is also a Cardinal, right?
Yes.
Yeah, Pugh has been a starter his entire time there in the NFL. I think we're about to start like hitting these drafts pretty hard and getting multiple picks every year because defensively, I think we have like 6 or 7 draft picks on this defense.
That's which, again,
makes the Maryland game very confusing. But I'm going to say that was probably more of a blip than hopefully a sign of things to come because like in another universe, if our offense came to play a bit and like help them out, like we probably would have only given up maybe like 30 points or so, maybe 35 on like that late touchdown.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the Clemson game, I think there's a lot of good we can take from it. I think in the Maryland game, I think the Clemson game proved that it was a one-off really weird thing. And there might've been more looking ahead than we thought, given all the rhetoric about the team beforehand, like not worrying about Clemson until we got there. But again, we'll see. We have 9 games left. There's a lot more to this season. And one of those games would be Western Michigan, who we definitely want to talk about a little bit before we bounce today. Dan, Vegas is either really high on Western Michigan or just wants to see who's willing to like troll bet against us. I saw the line opened at 4. It dipped to 3.5 quickly and then it's kind of bounced back up to 5.5, 6.
Yeah, I've seen 6. I wasn't checking it right at the open. The computer numbers, I think, are a big reason for that. S&P Plus, we are ranked 66th, and Western Michigan is below us at 77th. I haven't seen Bill's projections, like his head-to-head projections yet. I usually put those out, I think, later in the week.
Yeah.
But then FPI, ESPN's other proprietary metric.
It's made completely inadequate by Bill's.
Yeah, I like SP Plus a lot more. But I think most of like the smart football player people say FPI is still like worth it's like fine. FPI is Western Michigan 56th, and we are like 78th. So that actually gives Western Michigan a 55.8% chance to beat us.
Yeah. That FPI is way too reactionary. I mean, last year we saw it too with us, where, like, you know, once you win a game or once you play somebody close, like the fact that we had two, like, quote unquote, blowout losses, like, automatically, like, FPI just, like, course corrects and, like, tanks us.
Yeah, I need to find out. I mean, I need to look into, I think Bill has explained, like, the main differences, but although I don't think he is privy to what FPI bakes in. But they're both, like, they both have similarities. They're, like, kind of, they're done on the same, like, premise of, like, play-by-play power rankings, but they clearly have some major differences, especially with certain teams. Bill's pretty upfront about what goes
into it. As much. Yeah, like, I feel like Bill brings in previous results more.
And the recruiting rankings part's interesting. Yeah. He's trying to bake in, like, he's trying to find, like, a measure for talent. And ultimately, like, while recruiting rankings have major issues, they're still, like, the best thing we got, basically. So, yeah, it's a little less reactionary. And I think he's kind of adjusted for that. He tweets it every year, which I appreciate. So, yeah, based on whatever, which one of those you prefer, we're either a slight underdog or a slight favorite, I think, until, you know, we'll find out when Bill releases head-to-heads. So I think the main reason why I'm still optimistic, although those numbers did give me pause, I'm optimistic because, for whatever reason, like, our lack of familiarity with these teams has seemed to be a real issue. Obviously, Clemson, we didn't have that situation, but Venables like just threw a kitchen sink at us. The first 2 weeks, though, like, we admitted that not knowing what Liberty or Maryland was gonna look like was a major issue. We know exactly what Western Michigan's gonna look like. We played against Leicester last year. We're very familiar with them. We're familiar with the personnel. So I hope that gives us a major edge that we weren't getting in those first two games. And obviously, we have a talent advantage. We saw it last year. We're at the Dome, where I think we're gonna play better. So I'm still pretty high on the team going into this game, although I do think WMU is, like, a relatively tough G5, as we saw last year. Like, they gave us a game in the end there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Western Michigan definitely, like, came back and, like, tried to bite us in the ass last year, and then, you know, don't you get to come back in. SU ended up winning comfortably. It was really only one bad quarter that made that game look a little bit closer than it was. Western Michigan's passing offense is actually pretty good this year. I know they're throwing for 72% completion, 897 yards, 10.3 yards per attempt. But I feel like that actually plays into our strengths, pass rush and the defensive backs. Obviously, they're also a very good running team. They're top 40 in terms of yards per game, like 202, I believe. At the same time, like, you look at Western Michigan, like, got completely, like, blown out by, like, a Michigan State team that doesn't really have a great offense. I think Michigan State put up 51 against them.
Yeah, yeah, I'm looking at that. That's, like, the team I first went to, just because, like, that's the best team they've played. That's the Power Five team they've played. They won Michigan State won 51-17. The fact that Western Michigan put 17 up on Michigan State is almost impressive, because Michigan State just doesn't surrender points. I don't know, like, how that game flowed. Like, I don't think it looked particularly close at any point. The fact they gave up 51 points to a Michigan State team that, like, I think their goal this year is to score as few touchdowns and yet win as many games as possible. Like, they just do not like to score. They scored 28 against a pretty bad Tulsa defense, and then they scored 10 against or 7 against Arizona State. Not good. And they scored 51 on Western Michigan. So I'm not super concerned about Western Michigan's defense, because Michigan State is, like, the opposite of explosive on offense, and they dropped 50 on them.
Yeah, I mean, the defense, like, there were so many reasons to doubt them last year after, like, they pretty much imploded. Then everyone's like, okay, they brought back so much production. Like, I know even Bill C mentioned, like, you know, they bring back more production than anybody else, but then started losing players to injury, started losing players to transfer. The defense hasn't necessarily looked any better this year. I wouldn't say so. I'm not necessarily concerned with them. I think the big concern for me is just whether this offense can get out of its own way. And I would think that Dino Babers at least understands that and says, okay, like, Western Michigan has some weakness on that, and we really need to, like, I don't want to say we need style points, but, like, 24-0 is not going to cut it. Like, we need a game where we put up 35 plus. And that doesn't mean we have to win by 35. We need to put up 35 plus. We need to look the part of a P5 team that was ranked in the top 25 to start the year. and a team that, you know, can potentially win, you know, 7 or 8 games this season. So I think that, yeah, putting up over 30 against this Western Michigan team, I think, is essential to doing that. And I hope we do manage to pull that off. Lamonte Bellamy is really like the big concern here, but I do feel a lot better about the run defense after we actually looked pretty good for about a half and some change against Clemson. That was definitely an encouraging sign. I think in terms of the passing game, you know, John Wasink, like we saw him last year, he's done really well this year. But at the same time, like, you know, there's some caveats, obviously, against Michigan State. He threw for 252, but much lower completion percentage, only 6.8 yards per attempt, one TD, two picks against them. Most of his yards have been compiled against Monmouth and Georgia State. Georgia State win, to be honest, I thought was actually like some pretty nice work considering what Georgia State did to Tennessee just a couple weeks ago. I think this is a more winnable. I think this is a winnable game, and obviously, I think this is a game that SU should be able to win by double digits. If they don't, I think there's only going to fuel more concerns. And I think, you know, Babers obviously isn't on the hot seat or anything like that, but I think he understands that perception wise, like just find a way to put the Broncos away and leave no doubt that this team is getting back to form in this Saturday, hopefully.
Yeah. If you're going to score points against a decent opponent, this is it. Like I'm now diving in more. SP Plus has Western Michigan's defense ranked 104th in the country. FBI has them ranked 108th in the country. So by any metric, they are a bottom 30 defense. I don't think it's too much to ask them to put up like upwards of 40 points and at least look like pretty good doing it. If you don't, like, then I think it's cause for like real concern. But if they do, like I think like this is a perfect opportunity to right the ship, get a win where people can say like, oh, that's a decent Western Michigan team. They're probably going to win like 8 games this year, and just kind of get the course corrected and get like fans back on board. Say, hey, you know, Maryland thing was bad, but like there were, you know, it will correct it. Clemson is Clemson. We beat Western Michigan. We're back to 2-2. We'll go 3-2 next week with Holy Cross. And then, like, there's still a lot of opportunity ahead, whether it's, you know, 6, 7, 8 wins, whatever. Like, it's all laid out in front of us. Maybe you have one fewer win on paper than you expected. But, you know, ultimately, things are still in the general ballpark of where you expected. So I think this game's actually, like, now pretty important. But I'm not going to worry about it too much just because, you know, we've had these weird 2 weeks here.
Yeah, I mean, get the win, get back to 500, and then you get Holy Cross, which, you know, barring some sort of calamity, you know, that should be a win too. You get to 3-2 before the bye, lick your wounds a little bit, you figure out what you need to improve, and then you get NC State in a tough environment on a Thursday night down in Raleigh. Like, you and I said this before the season started, that like kind of, you know, NC State, Pitt, Florida State stretch is probably going to define a lot of this season. I think now so even more.
Teams have all looked like ass, like in different, like Pitt had the best weekend probably, and Pitt's best weekend was blowing a game at Penn State. They could have easily won if
Doozy doing the most Schaefer thing possible.
Yeah, if he had any like knowledge of how math works with regard to football, Florida State is just a mess. I guess you could say they hung with a decent Virginia team, but they somehow, like, I understand the clock had there was a clock issue. They ran like an inconceivably bad play on the final play of the game to lose it. Like, they're finding ways to lose, which is never a good thing and demoralizing, even if you're like staying with teams. Like, A, Florida State should never have to worry about staying with Virginia. But like how that game went just shows how much better Coach Bronco Mendenhall and Virginia are than what Willie Taggart sent at Florida State. And then NC State lost to what is very possibly going to be the 9th place team in the Big 12 in NC State, and then BC lost to Kansas. So like the ACC, even if we are not what we thought we're going to be, like the ACC is really bad this year. And I know we fought against that perception for a long time, especially like a couple years ago when, you know, the ACC wasn't getting its credit. And then 2017, the whole league looked pretty good overall. Things are not going super well over the last 2 years, and we used it to our advantage last year. I see no reason why we shouldn't do that again, even if we've had like these 2 rough weeks. We've had like the Maryland loss, I think, is way less bad than like what half a dozen ACC teams did this past weekend. So no reason to like not, you know, jump on the, you know, take advantage and jump on some of these other teams that are also having just bizarre seasons. And I'm not gonna worry about the conference rep, honestly, if it comes to Syracuse's advantage for a second year in a row.
Yeah. And I think that's something that everybody should really keep in mind. But I think we'll get to the ACC schedule when we get there. That'll be the second week of October before we get back to conference play. Dan, before we go, just a quick prediction for you in the Western Michigan game. I know we talked about it a little bit, but just if you have some numbers to stick to it, and if you think that SU is going to win by double digits, or whether they're going to play this one a little too close to the vest.
I think it'll probably be frightening for a while. I trust the team. I think Babers has to know like where we're at. He's realistic. I think he's going to be like, as well prepared as possible, because you can't keep on playing that card. Like, we know this offense that we're facing. We know the system. We just played them last year. We had a stare against them last year, which is probably good for us coming into this year. Like, we know you can't just like take your foot off the gas on this team. It's a pretty explosive MAC team, which like those teams win games like this on occasion. I'm going to go Syracuse 38-21.
Nice. I'm going to say 34-21. Just I think there's still some red zone issues. I think that leads to settling for a couple field goals. I think that SU's defense looks like they make some strides again, obviously adjust for your opponent a little bit, but the defense looks like it's more intact than it was 2 weeks ago and more intact than it was against Clemson, especially in the second half. I think the offense still doesn't look perfect, but I think that they find a way to look a little bit more competent. Really, like, what we need to start seeing is just some more pace. And if Tommy DeVito can just, you know, fire off better passes quicker, I know easier said than done, but I think, again, we do see some more semblance, like just more semblance of a decent passing game here. And hopefully, though, it's not the only thing that SU does right, because I think one of the bigger problems this year has been a lack of an established run game. So I think you'll see, even if DeVito doesn't put up amazing numbers, I think that'll be because Dino's actively trying to get this run game more involved and get them to, not the, maybe the level of last year, because that might be a little too much to ask given the offensive line issues, but get this run game to at least a more capable level where we're once again pulling teams and defenses in, so that we can, you know, kind of get some more options outside, get some more screen passes. Like, we really haven't seen a lot of one of the big reasons, I think, why we haven't seen a lot of great passing plays is because we haven't been able to run enough. So hopefully that, you know, starts getting corrected this weekend.
Yeah, I mean, whether it's run or pass, like, just we just need something going and some kind of coherent offensive vision, because we just haven't had it through three games. And while, like, obviously neither of us are selling Babers down the river by any stretch, like, I understand where the concerns are coming from. And, you know, we need to get it corrected because we have football games to win. So season is incredibly far from over. We can still accomplish pretty much everything we thought we were going to this year, realistically. But there are, you know, major concerns. And I think we have a very good two-game stretch to get them figured out before we dive into ACC play here.
Very much agreed. Dan, anything else before we go?
No, looking forward to the game. Looking forward to getting past like this Clemson week and getting through the narratives here, because they are exhausting. And hopefully, you know, everyone gets back on the same page and we're all satiated by a nice win over Western Michigan.
Agreed. Everyone, hope you have the ACC Network, if not at your home, at a friend's home or at a bar this weekend, so you can watch SU in that nooner against Western Michigan. That was Dan. I'm John. Thank you, everybody, for listening to Troy Noon's An Absolute Podcast. You can rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Megaphone, on Stitcher, on Spotify, on numerous other places that you listen to podcasts, and go Orange.
Go Orange.